When you're a cat, you're a cat for life. When you're a cat, you lazy fight with cats.
Was that Cars?
It was.
Okay.
So I can't not mash up the When You're a Jets. I can't even do it. I can't sing the When You're a Jet song. I always sing it to Gary Numan's Cars.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Have you seen the video?
Yeah, but not in a really long time. Like, is it one where there's like drawings?
No. So it's a really great video. There's neon like triangles.
Oh, okay.
And there's eyeliner. Big fan. Freeze frames.
Okay.
And Gary Numan lives very seriously in a tambourine in some parts.
Wow. So. And they say that music videos in the 80s leave something to be desired. I say, back to the classics.
So, welcome, threadlings.
Welcome.
Welcome to Check Your Threading.
Welcome to Musical Month.
Yeah. Which, are you sure you don't want to try? You don't want to try?
Nope, I'm good. You'll get my music. No, I'll sing later.
Okay.
It's part. Okay. Yeah, don't worry.
I'm really excited.
Don't be.
This is a bi-weekly podcast where we watch a movie, do a little research, and then create Check Your Threading, which is about culture, philosophy, personal feelings and thoughts on the movie we watched. So I'm Bonnie. I have a film theory background.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I sound kind of husky because I'm just getting over a cold, so enjoy that.
We will.
And I am now forever gluten-free, so.
Oh my gosh.
And I hate it.
I'm so sorry.
It makes me sad.
I'm so sorry. we'll have to find you some special things.
Yeah. Fun.
Cool. All right. Well, I'm Lauren. Thanks for making me follow that. And I have a creative writing background, and I feel a little guilty because the thing that I was going to share is that all the holiday baking ingredients are on sale now, and I bought three different kinds of baking chocolate this morning at the grocery store. But let's just pretend that those are all going to go in gluten-free cookies and bars and things like that. So
I love that for me.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about our movie. This episode. What are we?
We're going to a rumble.
Yeah. Linda Belcher is all over West Side Story, which I feel like matches her history growing up in clearly some East Coast enclave.
Yeah. And throwing rocks at cars and stuff.
Yeah. She's a jet all the way.
She would be. So West Side Story is the musical we watched this week. It is a 1961 musical drama directed by Jerome Robbins, adapted by Ernest Lehman, with musical numbers written and composed by Leonard Bernstein and a young Stephen Sondheim.
Fancy and dark.
So here's that IMDb sum for you.
Yeah.
Two youngsters from rival New York gangs fall in love, but tensions between their respective families build toward tragedy.
Okay. Good dramatic reading.
Thank you. Why don't you tell me about the Sharks?
I will. So I was going to talk about the sort of the history of Puerto Rican migration, because obviously that's a pretty big backdrop for the conflict in this movie. And the movie doesn't do a super great job of covering it other than being like, we're mad at each other. So so Puerto Rico became part of the U.S. in 1917. But we don't see a huge population boom in New York in terms of Puerto Ricans migrating, not immigrating, migrating, because it's part of the same country.
Right.
So they didn't start really to come to New York in strong numbers until the 1950s and 1960s. So let's talk about what caused that and why Puerto Ricans came to New York in such large numbers. To quickly sum up an extremely complicated history, a law was passed right before World War I or right after it that made exporting agricultural products from the island of Puerto Rico really expensive. Okay. So they were primarily an agricultural island, And then all of a sudden, nobody wanted their exports anymore, especially like the primary export was sugar. So that was kind of a problem. This law also drove the cost of living on the island up pretty intensely. And then during World War II, the U.S. government was like, okay, everybody stop farming, stop doing agricultural things. We need to do like a total makeover of your economy because we need you to start making like factory supplies for the troops, okay. Which is not unusual. Like there were a lot of areas of the U.S. that had this happen. So everybody stopped doing agricultural work and started doing factory manufacture, which was fine while the war was still happening.
Right.
But something funny happens after the war. In 1947, this initiative called Operation Bootstrap, Bonnie's least favorite phrase in the world, starts a permanent shift towards factory manufacturing. So basically the U.S. works with like the governor of Puerto Rico to come up with all these like laws and tax incentives to like bring continental U.S. Companies to like open factories in Puerto Rico. Okay. The only problem is that in the late 40s and 50s, once the U.S. is figuring out how to like open up trade with Asian countries again, doesn't care as much about Puerto Rico manufacture anymore. So like suddenly it's cheaper to get certain things from China or from Japan or for, you know, like places we weren't trading with for a while. And most impactfully, this affects the textile manufacture industry, which they refer to as needlework jobs. So a big part of the Puerto Rican economy was people would take cloth goods to their homes and sew them by hand. And this industry in Puerto Rico employed as many people as every other factory manufacturing industry job combined.
Wow.
At least in 1950. By 1960, it had plummeted to a mere 20% of that original number. So that's a huge contribution to the migration to the U.S. We see waves of Puerto Ricans coming to New York because the mainland government pulled the rug out from under them in the textile industry.
I see what you did there.
Ah, thank you. Yeah, rug joke. So it makes a lot of sense that Anita and Maria both work in a dress shop because that's a displaced, you know, talent or skill in Puerto Rico. And, you know, the movie opens up with Anita like flaunting her skills with a needle because that's like, it's a point of pride and it's a huge economic source of income for someone from Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
The other thing that increased migration pretty significantly was the ability to get on a passenger airplane and fly somewhere. It wasn't just for military transport anymore. Suddenly people could hop on a plane and that made transitioning to the continent a lot easier. So migration in the decade of 1940 to 1950 was about 150,000. Migration from 1950 to 1960, which is when West Side Story takes place, jumps to 470,000. So almost 500,000 people. Wow. This is all to New York. I'm talking strictly about New York. So we have 500,000 Puerto Ricans come to New York in this 10-year period. But like, why does that cause friction? Why does that matter? Right? Because New York is like a city of immigrants and migrants, depending on, you know, where you're coming from. So part of this pattern of American immigration is the constant need for the new group to elevate itself from the bottom of the ladder. And they do that by being cruel and demonstrating discrimination to the incoming group. So the Jets, who are Polish, Irish, and Italian, have all gone through their own historic periods of discrimination before the Puerto Ricans show up en masse. And we see this through the lens of the police characters who consider them all criminals and lowlives and like innately savage. So, you know, as a way of making themselves sort of feel better about this whole situation, they choose to turn this hatred back on the, you know, the Puerto Rican sharks as a way to elevate their own whiteness. There are Greeks and Italians in the Jets who look practically indiscernible from some of their shark enemies, but we have to create this invisible boundary to make ourselves feel better, basically.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was, I jumped on the phone with my mom and chatted with her about it because she grew up sort of in this era in New Jersey, and pretty much anything that happens in New York is also happening in New Jersey. Right. And she did talk about how like growing up Italian and like her high school got, you know, flooded with Puerto Rican students to the extent that her parents, my grandparents, pulled her out of public school because they didn't want her to go to school with Puerto Ricans.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was a huge thing.
Can we just say the obvious thing here about your grandparents.
My grandparents were some of the most racist people I have ever met, if that's what you mean.
Okay. Yes, that's what I mean.
Yeah. They taught me a lot of lessons about what not to do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So take me back to the beginning of musical talkies, singies. Is that our flashback music?
Yeah. Nice. Wayne's World, Scooby-Doo style.
Yeah.
So in order to understand the cultural relevance of West Side Story, I think we need to go back to like the beginning of musicals, not the 70s this time.
Oh, okay.
But all the way back to when musicals and Westerns were basically the staples of the classic Hollywood star system.
Okay.
Which is kind of the exploitation and contracting of stars, very young people, to come in and do these movies. So there's the big five studio system. Don't ask me to name all five studios. I will not remember them. Hollywood released more than 100 musical films in 1 year because they were just doing so well.
Wow. Okay. All right.
So this in part is due to the Great Depression. People needed to escape their lives. So, of course, musicals were great for that. And then in 1931, because of oversaturation, the studios only did 14 musicals that year.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Only one per month.
Then during the 1940s, there was a dip in popularity due to World War II because when you're surrounded by death and dying and war, it's kind of like watching a campy song and dance movie musical is kind of, in a way, disrespectful to the climate, you know?
Yeah.
It's not at the top of everyone's list.
Okay. Not quite feeling that vibe right now.
Right. So with the 50s came wide commercial use of Technicolor. And then we got that good shit like Singing in the Rain and Oklahoma, Funny Face, and others. And then the entire Hollywood industry went into a slow spiraling crisis because of television.
No. Okay.
So televisions were appearing in homes all over the nation. The rise of suburbia also caused its own set of issues since people were no longer as interested in, you know, traveling all the way to the nearest city to see a film.
Gotcha.
The television is literally in the next room. Like, why would they go all the way into the city?
This, you know, all sounds very familiar.
So by the early 60s, the studios were like really beginning to flounder. There was also this other thing going on within the Hollywood system where these young upstarts were coming in and trying to weasel their way into directing and, you know, cinematography and music and all this other stuff. And we call that the New Hollywood. This was the start of basically what became, you know, Steven Spielberg's time, Martin Scorsese, Kubrick.
Okay. So you're not so much a company man anymore. You're like, I'm an artist and I'm an individual.
Exactly.
Okay. Gotcha.
Which brings us to West Side Story. Okay. So I believe that West Side Story is truly a musical of the 60s. It was a breath of fresh air for a film genre that was starting to go stale and become completely irrelevant at that time.
Wow.
So originally, way back when, director Jerome Robbins approached his colleagues in the theater world with an idea for a musical called East Side Story, which was about a love affair between a Catholic and a Jew during Easter and Passover.
Oh, that's not what we got. That's a different story.
Yes.
So that's like the Weird Al Yankovic cover of West Side Story.
This show would eventually actually become AB's Irish Rose. And it was just, like you said, completely different from what Robbins had envisioned.
Okay.
So he went to his buddies, Arthur Lawrence, Leonard Bernstein, and a young Stephen Sondheim. And together they created the stage version of West Side Story. which apparently became a smash hit on Broadway and then eventually at the box office. And the funny thing is, the movie version got even more acclaim than the Broadway version did.
Okay, so this wasn't like a cult classic building time, like building popularity over 50 years. This was like right out of the gate, like everybody.
Instant.
Okay, instant classic.
Yes.
Okay.
So Sean Griffin, a professor of musical movies at the University of Dallas, says that musicals are a very American genre in the sense that they talk about individual freedom to the extent that one can even like dance on the ceiling, dance with a cartoon, or sing at the drop of a hat, you know?
Okay, okay.
And he also mentions that musicals are very involved with bringing together of community, which is a very American theme.
Yes.
We are united in our independence.
Right, of course. Right?
Which is why a movie like West Side Story is so set apart from traditional musicals. The community in West Side Story has like deep rifts, you know? Mm-hmm. And violence will erupt between those factions at any given moment. The Jets and the Sharks both have strong bonds respectively, and nothing but disgust for the other. With that in mind, this brings me to the metaphor of the racial politics in the dance sequences. And what you said earlier is really going to also speak to this. So I love it when that happens. So I'm going to focus on the prologue more than any of the other parts because I figure that's where it's most apparent.
Okay.
The whole damn movie opens up with the Jets taking up a lot of space and like confidently strolling through what is quickly assumed to be like their neighborhood.
Right, right.
And sort of finding reasons to just be dicks to the people who are hanging out, trying to do sports.
Yeah.
Or just fucking live their lives.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
It's like, come on, guys. So when we meet the Sharks, and that dance sequence ensues between the Jets and the Sharks, it's very difficult not to watch this and think of how whiteness tends to invade urban spaces and eventually overpower and take over those spaces.
Mm-hmm.
You see the Sharks in smaller groups as they try to gain territory, but the Jets are literally running them off scene in some cases, overpowering them at every turn. Even Puerto Ricans just, like, minding their own damn business, playing cards, are, like, being told to beat it, you know?
Yeah.
While on the outside, the dance is about gang members fighting over territory, what I really see underneath is ultimately a struggle to get a foothold in a place that is literally telling the Sharks to get the fuck out, even though they have every right to take up space there.
Yeah.
I also see, as far as the Jets, angry young men who have nothing in the world but the streets they live on, and so they fight their hardest to keep it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that really goes into what you were talking about. They had their trial by fire earlier, the Irish immigrants, the Polish immigrants, and so forth. And they already had their shit kicked. So yeah. Now it's their turn, you know?
Yeah.
And in a way, it's like a generational, like, this is what you do to the next immigrant who comes in. Mm-hmm. Even though Puerto Ricans, again, are citizens,
right? Totally.
You know?
Yeah, there's this whole conversation around like the transience of white privilege and like how Italians became white, and a big part of it was during this time, and like managing to separate themselves from, like, at one point they were basically lumped in with African Americans and treated as black, and then they worked very hard to say, fuck black people, we demand to be treated like white people. And it's like, cool, I'm so glad that's part of my history.
Your grandparents.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah. They grew up in that time, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And they were very, like, the whole reason we have Columbus Day is because Italians were lynched.
Can you explain, are you saying that that's what they're saying?
No, this is true. So Columbus Day became a national holiday because Italians were being murdered, like, for being Italian. And so there was this huge national push to, like, create, you know, a cool identifiable Italian hero. And that just happened to be Christopher Columbus. Don't pay attention to any of those other things that he did. And that, you know, is a big part of, like, how we managed to, like, normalize Italian identity in the United States. There's a great New York Times article about it that came out this year. I'll link to it in our stuff.
Oh my gosh, please do.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So like my grandparents who lived in New Jersey were like staunch supporters of the Knights of Columbus and like really, really intense about like, you know, we're Italian, but we're Italian Americans and we're white and we're not going to speak Italian in the home. And like, you know, all this stuff about like assimilate harder. And part of assimilation is joining the dominant white crowd in their discrimination of brown people. So that's what we're getting in West Side Story.
Holy shit.
I know.
West Side Story just got a lot crazier. So that's what the Jets are.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the Jets are trying to say almost like the Jets are in a way a metaphor for like assimilate.
Definitely. Puerto Ricans, definitely.
Or get the fuck out.
Yeah. So I know we wanted to talk a little bit about like the racism of the film itself. And, you know, there are some like brown face issues happening with like they only cast one Puerto Rican person in the entire movie, and like,
right,
you know, I feel like they probably got away with a lot under the auspices of, oh, well, this movie is about how, you know, racism is bad, so we're gonna just, you know, that means that we can say kind of bad things. I was reading this article by a curator of the New York Tenement Museum, which A, I think it's fascinating that that exists, and B, he sort of punts a little bit and quotes a Puerto Rican film scholar named Ernesto Acevedo or Acevedo Munoz. I'm sorry for my pronunciation. So Ernesto talks about how the initial reaction of the Puerto Rican community was to say that, like, yeah, there was some controversy, but like overwhelmingly everybody was really excited to see Puerto Rico on screen. Like, oh my God, we've never heard the word Puerto Rico in a movie before. And I think that's legitimate, but also like, okay, it's been 60 years. Like, is that, does the initial reaction and reception of the movie still hold water in a modern day audience that expects more from its viewing experience? And I definitely also found other essays by younger Puerto Ricans who were like, no, people talk about the brown face in this movie, but nobody talks about the inherent racism of the plot itself. We all seem to be sort of okay with that in general. Like that at the end of the day, this is still a story that like pretty much casts Puerto Ricans as gang members and inherently violent and all that stuff. So Ernesto's argument to that is that morally, the sharks come out looking a lot better at the end of the movie than the Jets.
I was just thinking that.
Yeah, the sharks are the ones, sort of, most of them are, you know, who are saying, like, shame on you, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not only the plot, but, like, the casting was extremely brown face oriented. Natalie Wood is not Latinx.
She had to go like tan. I believe they told her, go get a tan and come back and, you know, just keep up with that while you're on production.
Wow. I didn't hear about that, but I do know that she and the actor who played Bernardo both had to wear a ton of like brown makeup, like literal brown face. And then Rita Moreno talks about how they made her wear it too, so that she would be scaled, you know, brownly. I, if they're brown, you have to be also a shade of this. And she was like, but I'm Puerto Rican. We come in many different colors. Like, there's Afro Puerto Ricans. There's white Puerto Ricans. Like, why does the only Puerto Rican in this cast have to put on makeup? And they were like, what are you, racist?
Stop. Did they actually say that?
Yes.
Stop. God.
So.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
So real quick about Rita Moreno, I know what they're talking about when they talk about scaling. Mm-hmm. So there's this editing tool that they use to basically scale everyone so that everyone looks about the same on screen, you know?
Yeah.
However, if you are in 1965 Hollywood, you are scaling to white. So you are scaling to a Caucasian person. That's why you get these like insane differentiations in color and in contrast. And it sounds like in the case of this movie, they're trying to scale to brown. So she needs to be more brown.
Right.
But the normal is Caucasian color, which, you know, a creamy white color. So nobody was scaled correctly in movies unless they were white for years and years.
Right. Isn't like Raisin in the Sun a particularly like intense example of like how how shitty it was to try and film black people like under this white system, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So everyone go watch Moonlight.
yeah.
I was pretty amazed by the total lack of like desire to involve any Puerto Rican people in this movie at all, and I feel like that's worth talking about.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, Rita.
I know.
I freaking love her.
I know. She apparently this whole like she didn't tell the makeup story for a really long time. Like that just came out in an interview a couple of years ago. So
wow. Okay.
I think that she has had to deal with a lot of bullshit in Hollywood that hopefully is less prevalent, but we know that it's not gone.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
So,
is it question time?
I think it is question time. So question time is where we ask each other questions that the other person has not had a chance to prepare for, like a pop quiz. Mm-hmm. Hot shot.
Yeah. If you woke up one day and suddenly your life was a musical, would you rather your musical be a jukebox musical or original show?
Huh.
Content written for your life.
That it raises a lot of questions for me about the existence of like radio music in any musical system, whether it's a jukebox musical or not. Like, I just don't want to live in a world that doesn't also just like have music in it.
They do have music,
but I'm thinking too hard about this. I guess I'd rather be in a jukebox musical because. Well, if I don't, I mean, there's a problem either way if I don't know the words. I guess I just sort of assume that if your life is, an original composition musical, you know the words somehow.
Or do you?
Or do you?
Or is it just you singing? I mean, we already kind of live in musicals if the idea is you just basically burst into song about your stuff.
Yeah, I guess it's more the dance is more alarming. It's really the choreography and like strangers joining in with you that would make
right.
make it be like, whoa, hold on a minute.
And animals, strangers and animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, I don't feel comfortable with this.
Yeah. Bonnie sent me this amazing article, by the way, that we have to share out about West Side Story being like about people who dance and sing, but no one else in the world is under this spell. And
yeah.
and they're like aliens. It's an amazing read. Uh-huh. It's like, holy shit. Like, this is the world that I want.
We should. Yeah. We're going to link it
yeah.
in reference. It's like, West Side Story is the sci-fi postmodern musical we're all waiting for.
It's very convincing.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So why do you like West Side Story? Because we don't always talk about opinion. And I know that you like this is one of your fave movies.
I don't have a good answer for this other than just the music is fun. Part of it is that I love Stephen Sondheim. And I love his style. And I think I just have kind of followed him around without realizing it to a certain degree.
Okay.
I didn't start caring about names and like people behind the scenes until I was in my 20s or something so that I could start getting more of what I like,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
So I guess part of it is Sondheim. Part of it is, you know, the funness of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the younger me.
Sure.
That's the reason why I originally liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Me now, I think it's one of those things that you can just pick apart forever.
Yeah.
There's always going to be something new to find out about West Side Story.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Whether it be something that happened behind the scenes or a new analysis that comes out, you know, 50 years later or, you know, color theory. That kind of stuff.
Okay.
Like that could be said of a lot of movies, but it's fun in a musical sense because you don't really always get the sing and dance aspect on top of it all.
That yeah, know? That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's a good answer. I like that.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So I would love to hear some of your takeaways since you mentioned how much you love to analyze this movie.
So I think the compulsive heterosexuality of this film was a sign of those times. Mm. I love how you're looking at me right now.
I thought we weren't going to talk about all the gay stuff in this movie.
I said I wasn't going to talk about it in my spiel.
Oh, okay. All
right. This is my takeaway. So the compulsive heterosexuality of this film was a sign of the times. The fact that, like, at least two of the four men who wrote this musical nearly had their careers ruined by the McCarthy trials.
Hmm.
So four gay Jewish men wrote this musical.
Wow.
And not a single hint of it anywhere to be found. But I'm wondering if Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner are going to sprinkle in a little somewhere.
Loosen it up a little bit.
Yeah, because honestly, there's no reason not to at this point.
Yeah, totally.
And there's so much analysis and criticism around the fact that it is so heterosexual for no reason other than I think these guys, and this isn't fair because when you almost have your life completely ruined by your own government, it's not a just situation.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you know, it's because of the McCarthy trials and all that other stuff,
right,
that they probably couldn't write in some of the stuff they wanted to, you know, even subtly.
Yeah, yeah. And there's so much aggressive intimacy in this movie.
Yeah.
That, like, how do you not look at it, you know, through, what do they call it, the violet lens or whatever? There's definitely a lot of ways that I think you could queer this plot. And I guess it'll be interesting to see if they take any of them.
The violet lens.
I only have one, and so my takeaway is a legend. So a couple of months ago, I stumbled on a Radiolab episode about the legend of the New York subway singing the song Somewhere.
Oh, we're not cutting this, honey.
Okay.
No,
okay.
This is the best thing ever.
Okay. So I'm going to include a link to the Radiolab episode because part of the magic of their coverage is the way that they play the song and play the train so that you can hear how accurately it matches.
Okay.
And you know, in case you've never heard this legend, the part of it is that the song starts, "There's a place for us." So "there's a place" are the three notes that the subway makes when it pulls into the station. And if you live in New York, Bonnie's freaking out right now because Bonnie lived in New York. If you live in New York or you've ever ridden the trains there, you've heard "there's a place." So here's a very quick summary of why the trains sing Sondheim.
Can you kind of explain what that sound is before you go into why that sound is?
Sure. So we have the three notes from the song that open somewhere, and then we have three tones that the train generates in some way that you hear when you're standing on the platform waiting for the train to show up. And it's generally right as the train is either entering the station or leaving the station. And there's a lot of theory around, like, well, is it somebody on the Radiolab episode is like, oh, I just thought it was like the train rubbing up against something, which is really bad because if the train is constantly rubbing up against something at speed, that's not a good thing. But but it does sound like a friction sound. So what is making that sound? So here's what's making that sound.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s, New York City underwent this huge renovation of the train cars in the subway. And during this process, they discovered that the new trains that they want to install run on alternating current, which is basically like, you know, the power you have in your house, you plug it into the wall. This is Edison power. The old trains, and therefore the tracks that powered the old trains, ran on direct current, which is DC power, which is Tesla power, which means that the rails that power the old trains can't power the new trains. So it would be way too expensive to replace the rails. So what they do is they build a converter to translate the power from DC power, which is smooth, it goes ooh, to AC power, which is like a sine wave. It pulses and it goes ooh, ooh, ooh. So it would be totally unrealistic to change the kind of power that's supplied by the tracks. So they create this converter. And the transformation occurs in an object that Radiolab beautifully dubs the singing box. And every train has one, and it lives next to the engine. So it takes the smooth ooh DC power and turns it into the ooh, 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 AC power.
Mm-hmm.
And part of this process means jostling parts in the singing box, not the train rubbing against the walls of the subway. And this friction, this jostling, is energy, and it turns into a tone. And the tone turns into, there's a place.
Yes.
So something else important to know is that an engineer who creates this system has to choose a frequency for the whole thing to work. And for you want a frequency that achieves like a certain mathematical energy wave, but there's a little wiggle room. So you could theoretically customize the tone.
Mm-hmm.
So Radiolab tracks down this engineer who is a hilariously charming French-Canadian guy named Matt. Matt knows about the singing box, point number one. Point number two, Matt is a musician.
Mm.
Point number three, Matt's band covers AC/DC songs.
Oh my God.
In French. Point number four, Matt's band covers musicals in French. So Radiolab feels like they're onto something here. The West Side Story tribute may be intentional, but in the end, the tones are a complete coincidence. Matt has never seen West Side Story until after the programming of the singing box. But in a way, that doesn't even matter, because New York City takes on a life of its own. The subway is a creature, an entity of its own.
Mm-hmm.
Leonard Bernstein's daughter, Jamie, fully believes that the subway is singing somewhere.
Aww.
To the point that she like wants to stand up and like yell at people about it. Like it's the song. And at the end of the Radiolab episode, they talk about how somewhere is about a union of things, a union of places, a union of people coming together. And in this case, it's a union of alternating current and direct current, unifying and transforming for each other. And that's somewhere. That's what the song stands for.
Oh my
for.
God, I'm crying right now. I love that so much.
But you have to go listen to it, because if once you hear it, you'll never think that it's anything else again. And I was like crying in my office listening to this Radiolab episode.
Oh
so
totally.
please go listen to it and think about the magic behind coincidence in the universe.
And the other thing, when I think about what you're saying, the unifying current, it's also unifying the city itself through
totally.
Transport.
Totally. So. It's unifying Spanish Harlem and the island of Manhattan and, you know, the West Side and the East Side.
Oh my gosh, I love it so much.
Yeah.
It's so good. I'm glad that was one of your takeaways. I completely forgot that was a thing. So yeah.
I'm glad I could bring it back into your life. All right. So thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. Footnotes for every episode are available at checkyourthreading.com. And you can find us on Twitter at checkthreading or Instagram at checkyourthreading. You can also email your favorite song lyrics and your best dance moves to checkyourthreadingpod@gmail.com.
Nice. So our next episode will be Maleficent.
Ooh, that's not a musical.
So Lauren, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on with that?
So we are, because it'll be December, we are doing the theme of dysfunctional families.
Mm-hmm.
And that also includes bringing a new family member into the Check Your Threading tree. We're going to have a very special guest, our good friend Chad Edward Evett, who is a fantastic costume designer and has a lot of wonderful feelings about Maleficent and fairies and fairy tale telling in general.
That's right. Yeah. We're very excited. And yeah, so we'll see you in a couple weeks, Threadlings.
Yeah. Enjoy your wintertime wonders.
Ooh. Is it bap boop bap be da da ba doop beep bap deep boo? Skink,
dee
skink,
da
skink,
doo
skink,
da
skink.
Beedly dee 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 skeedly doodly doo. Yeah, it's like Michigan J Frog style action over here. We're both wearing green.
Oh, we are.
Hello, my honey. Hello, my something.
I was trying to do Winter Wonderland.
Oh, I'm sorry. unless you are our single devout listener in Australia, in which case it's not winter at all.
Right. Thank you, person from Australia, for listening, and others.
Yeah.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Bye.